by the soaring guns. Nothing compared to the smallpox and rum. All over this land there was never a storm. Winds of destruction like smallpox and rum.
Welcome to your weekly constitutional radio show about the Constitution, brought to you in partnership with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia, and I'm speaking to you today from the studios of WETS HD1 and WETS FM 89.5. This episode, well, it's going to begin with a bit of a background explanation. This episode started, as so often is the case, when I was reading the newspaper, and I saw a book review about a fascinating subject. The book in question was called simply Pox, and it was a book by a historian by the name of Michael Wilrich, and it promised to tell me the story of America's crusade against smallpox about 100 years ago at the beginning of the 20th century. And I thought to myself immediately, there had to be some civil liberties implications to that. And I wasn't disappointed, because when I read the book and I saw the story, I saw that faced with this dread disease that the United States government, through the army and also through the police of localities and through health departments, had adopted some pretty stringent policies, some pretty coercive policies in some cases, and that some people had objected to them. And in fact, at least one case, the Jacobson case, had gone all the way to the United States Supreme Court. And it was a fascinating historical discussion. I enjoyed talking to Michael Wilrich. He did a great job. And it was sort of toward the end of producing that episode that I was surprised to discover that an old college chum of mine, very, very nice fellow by the name of Mark Blaxell, had actually gotten involved with an ongoing and current controversy involving vaccinations. I had been more or less unaware that people were still feeling very strongly that vaccination was appropriate or inappropriate, or that people should be able to opt out or have a constitutional right to refuse. I was just sort of surprised, so I invited Mark on the show sort of to update the issue and to make the point that, you know, these constitutional issues never really go away. And at the end of the day, I was pleased with the episode that resulted. Boy, was I mistaken. I have never gotten quite so much email, quite so many phone messages, quite so many criticisms as I did at the end of that episode. And they basically boiled down to this. People were as concerned, if not more concerned, about the medical issues than they were about the constitutional issues. In fact, let me just share with you a couple of quotations from a couple of the emails I received after that first vaccination episode. Dear staff of your weekly constitutional, it is unconscionable and beyond irresponsible for you to allow the anti-vaccine spokesperson that I am currently hearing on the radio a free and critically unchallenged soapbox upon which to state his decidedly unscientific and biased opinion. The radio host is complicit in promoting this person's opinion, referring directly to the unfounded assertion that vaccines cause autism as a failure of the scientific method. Numerous large-scale and scientifically rigorous studies, in particular well-controlled population-based studies conducted on large databases in Scandinavia, have failed to show any association between vaccines and autism, and the idea of an autism epidemic itself is dubious at best, with rising rates reasonably accounted for by a loosening of the diagnostic criteria for autism, along with increased resources for assessment, identification, and treatment. And it just goes on from there. I mean, and it's very detailed and very not very happy with me from that first one. That was from one healthcare professional. Let me share with you an email from another one. Oh, let me see. What did this person say? Dear your weekly constitutional, assuming, without substantive evidence, that vaccination is the cause of autism or any other childhood condition is naive and dangerous. I understand that your guest is an intelligent, well-educated individual, but his presentation of this conspiracy theory against vaccination could result in otherwise well-meaning parents avoiding vaccinations that could save their children's lives. Well, again, these are serious concerns, and I take them seriously, and I have heard you. And I have to admit, mea culpa, I had the blinders on. In fact, I forgot one of the cardinal rules that all lawyers know, all lawyers who have been in a courtroom anyway, and that is that when you open the door on a topic, when you present one side of an issue, even if only as an example, people on the other side are going to want their time too. So mea culpa, I opened the door. And so this episode, today's episode, is our second episode on compulsory vaccination, our second bite at the apple. And this time we're going to very directly address the issue of the medical issue itself. And we're going to give both the pro and the anti-vaccination sides their full due. Now, interestingly enough, I was able to, we'll talk more to Mark Blaxwell, I should say. But first, we're going to talk to a fellow that has specialties in both medicine, both public health on the one side, and law. Now, his name is Professor Ed Richards, and he's a professor, a law professor at LSU, the Louisiana State University. And he's also been the director for the Center for Public Health Law at the, University of Missouri at Kansas City. He's done lots of different things involving both health law and other forms of law, including national security law. So he had some very strong opinions on this vaccination issue, both as it impacts individuals and the larger society. And so he's going to present the pro-vaccination viewpoint, broadly speaking. And then I'll have Mark back on to respond to some of Ed Richards' criticisms. And then we'll give Ed the last word this time around, since Mark had the last word last time. Okay, does that sound fair? I hope so. So let's begin with Ed Richards. He received his undergraduate degree from Rice University, where he studied environmental science, biology, and behavioral science. He did graduate work at Baylor College of Medicine, then the University of Michigan, before he received his JD from the University of Houston and his MPH, Master of Public Health, from the University of Texas School of Public Health. He was the Ruby Hewlin UMKC Professor of Law at the University of Missouri at Kansas City School of Law and the director for the Center for Public Health Law. More recently, since 2002, he's been the Harvey A. Peltier Professor of Law at Louisiana State University Law Center and Director of the Program in Law, Science, and Public Health. He's worked in public health and for many, many years. And since coming to LSU, he's done extensive work in national security law. Ed has been a consultant to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and other federal agencies and has authored more than 140 articles and 5 books. Now, when I spoke to Ed recently, he seemed to draw a line. He said there is a liberty interest in refusing vaccinations, a constitutional liberty interest, but it extends only so far as the communicability of the disease. That is, you can refuse vaccinations that are only designed to help you. But if they're designed to help the wider society, well, then maybe that liberty interest has to bow to the community interest.
So to the extent that there's an argument on a liberty interest to refuse a vaccine, then vaccines that are aimed at only protecting you that have no impact on the larger community except through the cost of your health care would probably be the strongest argument for that right. That's an issue we're confronting now as we try to deal with obesity. Mm-hmm. Does an individual being fat threaten the public health and safety through their health care costs, for example, to justify restrictions on either their personal life, such as fat taxes through insurance, or on the size sodas they can consume?
Hmm. Yeah, because obesity.
Philosophical argument.
No, because obesity is not contagious, right?
Not in the sense of communicable diseases. Certainly, it runs through families, through social patterns. But that's why it makes a complex constitutional problem.
Right. Okay. So if I want to refuse a vaccine, then I've got a fairly strong argument, or at least a relatively strong argument, for any of these diseases or the vaccines that are designed to prevent diseases that affect only me, like tetanus or like shingles. But I'm guessing you're going to suggest there's less of a liberty interest for other diseases.
Yes. As we get into what we think of as the traditional childhood vaccines, measles, mumps, rubella, diphtheria, pertussis, chickenpox nowadays, these are diseases that spread in the community. And for most of the folks who are affected, they are not life-threatening, nor do they leave permanent sequela. But for some particularly children in the population, they can be damaging. When I was a kid, we didn't have the measles vaccines. and measles epidemics would come through. There'd be tens of thousands of cases. Some children would die, some would end up blind, some would end up with permanent brain injury. Measles vaccine has significantly reduced the morbidity and mortality from measles. You might remember from either television shows about conquerors going to to islands that had never seen them before, or reading historical works like William H. McNeill's Plagues and People, that when measles would get introduced into a community that had never seen measles before, it might kill 30 or 40, 50% of the people.
Wow.
That's because it's not that the measles virus was any more deadly, but if everybody gets sick at the same time, nobody can take care of anybody else. Nobody can go for water or food, and so it decimates the community. So in a world in which most people have had measles, then new cases of measles don't have that effect. But that becomes important because when you control a vaccine-preventable disease, and after a while you quit vaccinating people because you don't see the disease, then the population becomes susceptible. In the case of smallpox, we stopped doing smallpox vaccinations in the U.S. in the 70s. We basically stopped doing them routinely worldwide in the 80s. And now the large majority of the world's population has not been immunized, and for those of us who are old enough to have been immunized, our immunity's mostly worn off. So the whole world is like that Hawaiian island before the first sailor with measles shows up. That's what creates the national security risk, is the risk of synchronous infection across a large segment of the population, which means that your infrastructure fails.
Now you're starting to scare me, because this is reminding me of accounts that I've read of the so-called Columbian Exchange and what happened to the natives of North America in the immediate aftermath of the arrival of the Europeans around 1492.
Exactly.
Some of the estimates I've seen were like 70 or 80% of the population died within 10 years.
That's right. And in some cases, they died, you know, through a single outbreak, because it breaks down societal order. In our complex society, it means people aren't going to be there to man the power plants. They're not going to be able to maintain critical infrastructure. The first responders will not be responding, and that means the consequences of the illness become much more severe. If you overload our healthcare system, then the people that would have been fine with reasonable healthcare don't get any healthcare. That's how these diseases tip over into a clearly recognizable national security threat.
Okay, let me just make sure I go through the process again. You've got, let's go back, pre-vaccination, several hundred years. Diseases are horrible. Lots of people die from them. But those who don't die develop some level of immunity.
For most of the diseases, yes.
Okay, for most of those diseases. But then we've developed modern vaccination regimes and have eliminated a number of these diseases, and that's wonderful news, and it's great, and people don't die nearly as frequently. They don't suffer these dread diseases. But if I understood you correctly, that means that after we get to the point of virtually or controlling or eliminating a disease, and we stop vaccinating, then we are actually creating a vulnerability that makes it a big issue, that we've essentially created a society where we're like the North Americans before the Europeans arrived, or where we're like the Hawaiians before the explorers arrived.
Exactly. And that is our fear with smallpox. We don't know if there's any smallpox virus left. There is potentially unaccounted for large store of smallpox virus that was lost from the Soviet Union's bioweapons lab, Biopreparat, at the breakdown of the Soviet Union, but we have no good data on that. So that's potentially out there. That requires us to think about smallpox bioterrorism.
I have to slow you down on that one, because it's something I know a little bit about it from a distance. I remember in the last days of the Soviet Union, or around the time that the Soviet Union fell, that there was discussion between both American and Soviet scientists that perhaps they should go ahead and destroy the stores of smallpox virus that each of them had. And of course, each of them was saying they were keeping it for only research purposes and, you know, to make sure that they could combat any outbreaks. But the argument was, well, these are the only remaining stores, so maybe you should go ahead and get rid of them, and then we can truly say we've conquered the disease. But now you've just told me something I didn't know, and that is
right,
that some of those are missing.
When those scientists were going through those discussions, they didn't know that the national security people had already found out from a defector, Ken Allebeck, that there was potentially tons of this stuff that were outside the system that had disappeared. Now, we don't
You're
know...
You're scaring me again, Ed. You're scaring me.
We don't know if the defector is telling a good story to get a better deal,
mm-hmm.
or he's telling us the truth.
Right.
But we're kind of betting the world on the outcome.
Okay. So
now, you could imagine that polio, we're close to eradication, except that the war in Afghanistan is probably holding that up for a while.
Haven't there been outbreaks in Nigeria, too? Wasn't it Nigeria where I was reading about?
Yes, there are some there.
Because they stopped vaccination. A few of the, I think I understood the mullahs, the Muslim clerics, were refusing it for some period of time.
Well, yes, they thought that the vaccination people were basically in league with the U.S. occupiers and the drone strike guys. So a little foreign policy bleed. But you can imagine that we could eradicate polio, and that after a period of time we would stop giving polio vaccines.
Mm-hmm.
If we were to eradicate measles, you can these diseases that don't have any natural host except for man, it is possible to eradicate. But as you tick each of those off, you get into this dilemma. Would we have public support to continue vaccinating after there were no more cases in the wild, or would it become like smallpox? Now, there was tremendous debate about whether we should keep vaccinating people against smallpox. That one's complicated because smallpox, among all of the currently used vaccines, is the only one that is actually significantly dangerous. So there are significant risks to the smallpox vaccine. So the risk calculus makes sense, but it does leave you in a fairly vulnerable position if you've guessed wrong about about smallpox in the environment.
Okay. Well, we should get to the issue then. I think I know where you're going to go with this, but I'll let you explain your position. I'm going to guess that with regard to these communicable diseases, that you don't think that people should have an individual liberty interest to refuse vaccination.
I don't, and I don't want to make the argument that there's no risk at all to vaccines. Their vaccine risk, except for smallpox, is in fact quite low, and we can identify people that are at higher risk of complications, and they've always been excluded from vaccine programs. But it's more important to see this like the draft. This is a part of the civic duty. You accept your small risk for the public good. And sadly, this anti-vaccine position, which has become quite widespread in the modern United States, is an example of this larger issue of the free rider problem.
Well, before we get into that, let's explain in a little bit more detail. Now, exactly why do we have a duty to get vaccinated and accept some degree of risk for these diseases? Is there some concept that we were going to talk about? I think herd immunity is something like that.
Well, the idea is that if you have enough people vaccinated in the population, it's hard for an infected person to run into another person who is susceptible to infection. So even if you get a case of measles introduced from a foreign trip, the child with the measles has a pretty low probability of spreading it to anyone else. And that slows the spread of disease. It gives you time to identify the contacts and basically stop the spread. Now, because we have this large group of immunosuppressed people in our population, we have, of course, adults and children living with HIV. We have large numbers of folks now that have organ transplants or on immunosuppressive drugs. We have a lot of folks on cancer chemotherapeutic agents, which are pretty much all immunosuppressive. We have a lot of folks with severe arthritis being treated with drugs like methotrexate, which is an immunosuppressive cancer drug. We have folks with asthma on chronic steroids. We have millions of people that didn't exist in our population 50 years ago who are very susceptible to major complications from these illnesses and who are basically not able to protect themselves through vaccination, either because the vaccine is dangerous to them or because they can't get and develop enough natural immunity because of their suppressed immune system.
Okay, you're not identifying vulnerability on top of vulnerability. So a moment ago, you told me that because we've stopped vaccinating for certain diseases like smallpox, that we have no immunity to them naturally anymore. So we're vulnerable in that regard. And now you're telling me also that we have a population that has a number, millions in fact, of people who for a variety of reasons have suppressed immune systems, making them yet more vulnerable.
Yes. In one of the recent measles outbreaks, it was driven by the sort of the dual problem that not only do we allow a lot of people to opt their children out of vaccinations, but they tend to cluster together so they're not evenly distributed in the population. So they'll go to the same daycare or shop at the same crazy grocery store. So it makes it very easy to spread disease, and thus we get these outbreaks. There was a very poignant story written up in some of the media about a child who nearly died of measles, who was a child who couldn't be vaccinated on his own and was infected by a neighbor's family who had refused vaccination.
So that's where the duty comes in. So if I'm a parent and I'm confronted with the choice as to whether or not to try to opt my kid out of compulsory vaccination, it's your position then that unless I've got some very good reason for not having my kid vaccinated, I should go ahead and do it and accept whatever risk goes along with it, because otherwise I might decrease the so-called herd immunity and I might present a risk to third parties. Is that a fair statement?
That's a fair statement. And we provide the National Childhood Vaccination Compensation Fund to provide compensation for any legitimate childhood vaccine-caused injuries. And that system is an administrative compensation system, so it allows the claims to be evaluated by proper experts. They're eventually reviewable in court, but in that case you're dealing with the appeals courts using agency deference to the experts to evaluate them rather than, you know, the emotional appeals to jurors that really undermine the ability to do good vaccine policy.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned something a moment ago about exemptions from vaccine laws. Now, most vaccine laws are state laws, right?
Yes.
Okay, and so they're variants from state to state, and then I'm guessing states have different requirements as to who has to be vaccinated and who doesn't.
Not as much as you'd think, because the states are generally cheap, and they rely on the federal government through the Centers for Disease Control to fund their vaccine programs.
Mm-hmm.
And so the CDC, through the spending power, basically makes vaccine and public health funding contingent on following some national guidelines.
Ah, there's a bit of constitutional law. The federal spending power in Article 1, Section 8, virtually without limit, and essentially when the federal government comes by with its great big purse and wants to spend a bunch of money on something, it can add whatever conditions, generally speaking, it wants to. So that's the mechanism through which the CDC exercises its nationwide vaccination control?
Exactly, because the CDC actually has essentially no regulatory powers. It has some historic power left over for steamship sanitation, but everything it does, except for that narrow area, it is doing through spending power and counting on the fact that states have been essentially defunding their public health departments for decades, so that as long as the feds have the money, the states will pretty much follow their guidelines.
It is, in fact, your weekly constitutional. We seem to be talking a lot about non-constitutional things here, a lot about medicine and vaccines, and there's a reason for that. This is our second episode on the issue of compulsory vaccination. Back by popular demand, we're going to tell both sides of the vaccination or anti-vaccination story. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and hear some more from Ed Richards, a professor of law and of public health at Louisiana State University. Stick around.
It was the flu pandemic, and it swept the whole world wide. It caught soldiers and civilians, and they died. Whether lying in the trenches or lying in their beds, 20 million of them got it, and they're dead.
Once again, Kelly Carmichael strides into the studio in spirit, if not in person, and shares with us a difficult quiz question.
Well, hello, how are you?
I'm doing extremely well. What's your question this week, Kelly?
All right. Something about going into the Declaration of Independence.
Mm-hmm.
Citizens vote for their representatives in government. Which of the following statements from the Declaration of Independence reflects this principle? That citizens vote for their representatives in government.
Okay.
Is it A, among these rights are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness?
Mm-hmm.
B, all men are created equal. C, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. Or D, they are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights.
Wow, those are all interesting choices, and they all have that wonderful Jeffersonian ring to them. And of course, we have to clarify that the Declaration is not part of the Constitution, but it also is a very important document that does inform our democracy and is something we often look to for certainly guidance and inspiration. So it's appropriate we look at it. But Kelly, could you repeat the question one more time now that I've mucked everything up by talking all about the Declaration of Independence?
Sure, here we go. Which of the following statements from the Declaration of Independence best reflects the idea that citizens vote for their representatives in government, which is how our Constitution has structured?
Sure.
Structured this. Is it A, among these rights are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness? B, all men are created equal? C, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed? Or D, they are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights.
Okay, so which of those four statements reflects the fact that we vote for the people who represent us? Let's go to our contestant and see what the answer is. And on the line we have Caitlin. Caitlin, where are you from?
I'm from Grundy, Virginia.
You're from Grundy, Virginia. From you're originally from Grundy. That's where you're from?
Yes, born and raised, unfortunately, or fortunately.
Wow, I'd say that's extremely fortunate because, of course, it's such a beautiful place. Okay, Caitlin, well, you had a chance to listen to the question there. Let's go through the answer choices one by one, and you can tell me what you think of them. And I think it's which of the following reflects the idea that citizens vote for their representatives? Is it A, the idea of life, liberty, and a pursuit of happiness?
Well, I like that answer, but I don't think that would be the reason why we would vote for a representative in government.
Doesn't voting make you happy?
Yes, but I just don't think that answer best reflects the reason for voting a representative in government.
All right. Well, hold on. Let's go on to B then. How about the idea that all men are created equal?
Once again, I don't think it best reflects the reason we would vote for our representatives.
Well, I wonder if this is a woman thing. Are you reacting to that men thing in there? I mean, it's just us guys who are equal. And okay, we'll go on to answer choice C. What about the idea of deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed?
I think that's a very good answer.
Why is that a good answer?
Because it sounds like the powers from, did it say from the consent of the governed?
Yeah, the consent of the governed.
Governments
derive their just powers from the consent of the governed.
I just think that sounds like an answer that the power comes from the people.
And they exercise it through their votes, I guess.
Maybe.
Oh, well, now you're backing off. What about D, endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights?
I like that answer, too. But I don't think, maybe the inalienable right is to vote. I don't know. This is a tough question.
A tough one. Endowed by their creator. I don't know if God needs to vote. I think he just kind of says things and they happen, you know. But so which do you like? Is it between C and D?
Yes, but I think I'm going to stick to my answer. I really want this T-shirt, but I'm going to go with C.
Is that your final answer, Caitlin?
Yes, that's the final answer.
All right, let's go ask Kelly what the correct answer is. Well, Kelly, what's the answer to this voting type question?
The answer about citizens vote for their representatives in government is best reflected in the answer C, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed.
Well, Caitlin, congratulations. You get a T-shirt.
Oh, thank you. I'm going to be a cool kid on campus
You're going to be the cool kid on campus, and all the guys will be after you. That's the magic of these T-shirts. All right. Caitlin, thank you very much for playing.
Thank you.
It's your weekly Constitutional, and we're speaking with Ed Richards, the Harvey A. Peltier Professor of Law at Louisiana State University Law Center and the Director of the Program in Law, Science, and Public Health. He's fairly pro-vaccination, or he's very critical, I should say, of those who might be called anti-vaccinationists. And Ed and I have been having an interesting and spirited discussion all about the pros and cons of vaccination, and now we're going to shift slightly and go in a slightly different direction. If I could shift focus just slightly again, though, you mentioned before people who are opposed to vaccinations and who are refusing them in some cases. Among the many reasons that are sometimes cited for such refusal is, of course, the alleged link between vaccines and autism. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's a well-orchestrated campaign by the trial lawyers to prey on the fears of parents, and it has been a fraud from the first day. Some of these disputes have some legitimate background. That one never did. It was an end run on the Vaccine Compensation Act, basically looking at the structure of the act, which clearly would prevent litigation based on the actual biologicals in the vaccine, and trying to make an argument that it was related to the mercury preservative as a way to take it out from under the coverage of the act. There was never any epidemiologic support for the arguments. The best I can say about the folks that have been advocating that is that they may be just obsessed, well-meaning cranks, but I think most of them, it's a lot more sinister. They prey on the fears of parents. They give parents a false hope that there's a reason this may have happened, so the parents don't blame themselves. It's been one of the most cold-blooded, manipulative anti-science campaigns that we've had to deal with.
Well, gee, Ed, how do you really feel about it?
Well, we're on a radio broadcast, so I can't tell you that.
No, that's also some fairly strong statements there, so I guess this is something you've dealt with before.
Yes. I am an administrative law guy because of the difficulty of dealing with science and juries. And the vaccine issues have been complex. Early on in the late 50s, when the first polio vaccine was being rolled out, we actually had an error at Cutter Labs. They made a batch of vaccine where the virus had not been killed, and we gave a couple of hundred kids polio. That's a legitimate vaccine injury, but sadly it shaped the whole view of the vaccine injury. Then when we had the swine flu immunization program in the 70s, for a while people thought that vaccine caused Guillain-Barré syndrome. Now better epidemiology has shown in retrospect that wasn't true, but again, a lot of compensation money was paid out. People have developed this idea that the vaccines are dangerous. From a plaintiff's lawyer's perspective, and I was a plaintiff's lawyer once and have taught torts for many years and off and on, it's the perfect confluence. You have a little child with some horrible illness that's not anybody's fault, and you're blaming a pharmaceutical company. And Lord knows, pharmaceutical companies are not lovable people. You have bad epidemiology in front of juries. Probably there's nothing more complex for a jury to figure out than epidemiologic issues of proof. It's a perfect confluence for getting big jury verdicts. That's why we moved to the Vaccine Compensation Fund, in order to deal with this in a more rational way for the small number of real injuries. It has undermined our public health system. It has undermined the faith in the vaccine system. It leaves us vulnerable, and what some of us really worry about is if we were to have a threat of a new flu, for example, that was a significant threat. Most of the ones that have been trumpeted lately have not really been significant threats. But if we had one, we're not in a very good position to develop and roll out a vaccine through the public. This fear has caused the Centers of Disease Control to even change its strategy for response to a smallpox bioterrorism event to an approach that would probably be significantly less effective, because they didn't want to say in public that their very first thing would be to roll out mass immunizations for the whole country. That's not politically acceptable.
Well, let me ask you a different question. One of the criticisms that I hear from the people who are concerned about vaccines and concerned about the alleged link with autism, et cetera, is that they feel that the existing medical establishment has gotten a little too cozy with the pharmaceutical industry, and perhaps there are conflicts of interest and a lack of oversight. The typical bureaucratic problems that do crop up in government from time to time, and certainly in the medical arena. Do you see any problem there that needs correcting?
Well, I think you have to distinguish the traditional vaccines, which are... they've basically been developed for decades. They are done on almost a cost-plus basis on federal contracts. Pretty much the CDC is the buyer for all of this stuff. They're somewhat immune to the whole perverse incentive world that brings us things like Vioxx. I am a significant critic of the pharmaceutical industry on a lot of new drug stuff. The vaccines live in a different world. Occasionally, there's an overlap when the new vaccines come in, the HPV vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of controversy because, in fact, one manufacturer was pushing states to require this as fast as possible because they knew a competing and somewhat better vaccine was coming down the pipeline. But if you had the first vaccine, you probably wouldn't get the second one. So if they didn't get states to vaccinate kids in a hurry, they'd get displaced from the market. That's a legitimate concern. But these other vaccines are, they're out of patent, they're generics. This is not subject to this, new drug, huge overprescribing on a poorly tested drug problem that we see in some other contexts. So I think the criticism of the pharmaceutical industry is well-founded in a lot of areas. The vaccine world for established vaccines is almost completely separate from that particular set of perverse incentives.
I see. Well, another criticism that I hear from people in that community who are concerned about vaccines and vaccine safety is that perhaps we're vaccinating for some diseases that we really don't need to vaccinate for, and one that I've heard particular complaints about is chickenpox. And I seem to recall when I was a child that I got chicken pox, and it was a relatively mild and not particularly pleasant experience. But in the 60s, it was pretty much accepted that pretty much every child was going to get it, and they would suffer through it, and then they'd be immune. Now we have a chicken pox vaccine. Is that a case of vaccinating when we really don't need to?
Well, let's think about chicken pox. Yeah, they're immune, sort of, to another outbreak of chicken pox, although it's not a complete immunity. But they are infected for the rest of their life with chickenpox vaccine, which then, and they get later in life, manifests as horrible cases of shingles.
Mm-hmm.
So the chickenpox vaccine for kids is, you have to think of it as the pre-shingles vaccine for adults. If you're among the fraction of the kids that develop total immunity, you aren't going to have shingles later in life. The other thing we didn't have...
Well, just before we go on, then, I had chicken pox back in, 1965 or 66. Chances are that I have total immunity or that I only have partial immunity?
Well, we won't... You're past the point where that matters. Kids can get more than one case of chicken pox.
Mm-hmm.
Some kids. But what you do have is you've got chicken pox virus embedded in your nerves.
You're scaring me again, Ed. Okay, so...
And, under the right circumstances of stress or the like, mm-hmm. you can break out with shingles.
Now, that's not life-threatening, is it?
Well, it can make you so miserable you might want to kill yourself. it can completely incapacitate you.
Right.
It generally doesn't kill you.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing you're forgetting is, remember, we now have this universe of immunosuppressed people. they are very prone to things like chickenpox and encephalopathy.
Mm-hmm.
So the risk is significantly different than when you were a kid. And frankly, when you were a kid, we took for granted that a certain number of kids died every year from these illnesses. We're not very tolerant of kids dying from childhood illnesses anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So our acceptance of risk has changed. At the same time, our real risk has significantly increased.
That's interesting. Let me ask you about another specific one, because I was reminded when we were talking about chicken pox, and another one, mumps. I got a case of the mumps, and that was pretty much expected. The kids were going to get that. Can we talk about that one? And whether, I know we vaccinate against that one now, don't we?
We do, and there were some kids that got sequela of mumps. Because not everybody got mumps, you had adults that survived, folks who survived into adulthood who did not have mumps. You get, particularly for a man, you get mumps as an adult, you are prone to a really nasty complication that will affect your sexual organs, then is not only incredibly uncomfortable, but can in fact be permanently damaging.
I have to ask to tell me what that complication is.
Well, I frankly am not comfortable trying to remember the technical name,
mm-hmm.
but let's imagine that things swell up and hurt and make become permanently scarred.
Okay, that's probably enough detail. now I'm glad I had them. I hope I have complete immunity now.
Exactly. And that's what was always one of the issues, is that if not everybody got these diseases and developed immunity, and some of them are much more severe in adulthood. For women in particular, what you were worried about is if you didn't get your measles until you were pregnant, then your kid had horrible congenital measles, you know, central nervous system problems, mental retardation, perhaps even death in utero.
Mm-hmm.
So we vaccinate to reduce measles in order to also reduce the effect on pregnant women.
Mm-hmm. Another vulnerable population.
Absolutely.
All right.
Then you start thinking about this in terms of these vulnerable populations rather than in terms of individuals making these kind of Ayn Randian individual choices to assume risk, you can understand why the public health folks are pretty short-tempered with the vaccine deniers.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I've been speaking about vaccinations with Ed Richards, a professor of law at Louisiana State University Law Center and the director of the program in law, science, and public health. After the break, we'll hear from the other side. We'll talk again to Mark Blaxwell, whom we've heard from before, all about his concerns regarding vaccination. Of course, we'll have This Week at Montpelier, and then we'll get back to Mark.
They inject you, they infect you, they stick a needle in your arm and chemically wreck you, they use you, they abuse you, they say they're saving your life while they really confuse you. All you parents, grab your kids and shoot them up just like guinea pigs. Inject your teens and your babies in the crib. And when they get paralyzed, that's when you realize there's no way to undo what you did. The big drug companies are making the killing, collecting the billions.
Well, Lynn Yazell, welcome back to the show, and tell us what's happening this week at Montpelier.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about a very exciting upcoming Bill of Rights course that people can take online.
An online Bill of Rights course. My goodness.
This will be an introductory course to the Bill of Rights, and anybody who would like to is able to take it. It is designed for school teachers to offer to their high school students. It is designed for anybody who wants to know a little bit something more about the Bill of Rights.
Well, that sounds like a good complement to the basic introductory course on the Constitution.
As a matter of fact, I think it's an excellent complement.
Now, is there any cost for this?
It is absolutely free.
Mm-hmm. And how do people get to it? How do they take the course?
Well, they only need to go to the website, Montpelier.org, go into the Center for the Constitution, and immediately you will see a link for signing up. That is the only thing that people need to do is sign up for it.
So what are they going to find in this online course?
Well, it is going to have a little bit of everything. There's going to be some reading material. There's going to be some videos. There's going to be some examinations to see if people are absorbing what it is that they're learning.
Mm-hmm. Optional examinations. They don't get a grade, right?
There's no grade.
No grade. Okay. So it's just for their own edification. That's very interesting. And who's putting this together?
Well, Stuart, two eminent scholars are putting it together.
Really? Who might they be?
One would be Stuart Harris.
Oh, my goodness gracious. I know that fellow. And who's the other one?
The other one would be Lynn Uzel.
Even more eminent. Tremendous. So it's a collaboration between you and me and, of course, all the people at the center. And there's going to be a video segment as well, right?
I mean, that is correct. And the video segment brings together even more scholars.
Yeah, it does.
Panel discussions on each one of the amendments.
Mm-hmm. So it's interactive, it's multimedia, it is fascinating stuff. I know there's great historical stuff because I've seen some of the stuff you've written on history, and there's some modern stuff as well.
Provocative modern questions as well, pro-con debates.
Yes, we've got debates, we've got questions, we hope we've got answers. So thanks very much, Lynn Uzel, and for telling us all about the online course.
My pleasure.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and we're talking about compulsory vaccinations, the constitutional issues, do you have a right to refuse vaccinations, as well as the scientific and health issues. We've heard from Ed Richards of LSU. Now let's hear from Mark Blaxall, who is one of the founders of the Canary Party. Well, Mark Blaxall, welcome back to your weekly Constitutional.
Thanks for having me, Stuart.
Well, I tell you what, that last episode we did with you on compulsory vaccinations, I don't think we've had another episode that has generated as much listener response. We got calls, we got emails. You're just a troublemaking kind of guy.
Well, it is a controversial hot-button issue, Stuart, for sure.
It certainly is. And in fact, I've just been speaking with Ed Richards, who's a public health fellow and a law professor down at LSU. And he made several arguments against your position, and I essentially just wanted to run them past you and give you a chance to respond to them. The first one that he makes, his basic point seems to be, is that he agrees that citizens should have and do have a liberty interest, a constitutional liberty interest in refusing vaccinations, but only in the situation where such refusal could hurt only them. You know, that is, if I'm an adult and you want to vaccinate me for tetanus and I don't want to and I'm the only one that might suffer for it, well, then fine, in Richards's opinion, then, you know, I should be able to refuse. But he has a very, very different attitude when he thinks that refusing vaccination of a transmissible disease, like polio, for example, might actually reduce what he calls herd immunity and might expose my community to some additional risk. So how do you respond to that position?
Well, it's an interesting question. There is certainly a communal interest in herd immunity. The question becomes, if you deny the right of the individual to make the judgment as to whether or not they want to promote the communal interest, where is the check and balance on the policy and who decides what the communal interest is? One of the concerns a lot of us have, Stuart, is that the public health industry, and it is an industry, you know, we talk about the military-industrial complex, and everyone sort of acknowledges what that is. Well, there's also a medical-industrial complex that includes the regulators, the government agencies involved, the pharmaceutical companies and vaccine manufacturers, the associations of doctors that administer vaccinations. And generally, you know, when the regulatory apparatus that recommends, that makes policy recommendations is captive to financial interests, it's very possible, and a lot of us argue that this is the reality today, that, you know, the decisions about promotion of vaccines and adoption of vaccines and mandating of vaccines are compromised and are biased. And if you remove the liberty interest, you remove the right of citizens to claim exemptions. Where is the check and balance in the system for required medical interventions that might actually not be good policy? And these aren't policies that we vote on. These aren't policies that Congress or legislators decide. They are all relegated to expert bodies. And these expert bodies are, by and large, you know, inside the club. People who have financial invested in career interests in promoting these policies.
I also asked Mark Blaxall about one of Ed Richards's other concerns, emergency situations. But let's just say that somewhere there's some reservoir of smallpox. Maybe it's in a lab somewhere, and maybe it gets out. In a circumstance like that, we might have a very quick global outbreak of a dread disease that somehow makes its way back into the population. In that circumstance, that said, the government has to have the power to mandate widespread vaccinations on an emergency basis. Did you have any reaction to that sort of government exercise of power?
It's such an extreme scenario, Stuart. Mm-hmm. First of all, we would have enough information. Traditional public health measures would be, we couldn't possibly vaccinate enough of the population in that short a period of time to make a difference. You would do quarantine, you would, share information about the spread of the virus. Smallpox doesn't spread that rapidly. There would be all sorts of mechanisms. There was actually a program a while back to immunize healthcare workers against smallpox. And one of the things that happened was that a lot of healthcare workers refused the vaccine because they knew that there were actually relatively serious adverse events associated with smallpox. So smallpox is a good example, but it's actually not a good example where that degree of coercion would be necessary. And in fact, as we introduced it to populations, a lot of educated people, healthcare providers said, whoa, wait a minute. This is an extreme measure. I don't want to get this vaccine because it's risky and I don't see the benefits. So, if you don't allow populations to vote, if you don't allow legislators to vote, if you don't have any kind of check and balance on the quote-unquote experts who are mandating these things, you can get tyrannical interventions made by very small groups of people who actually make bad decisions. How do you control?
Well, but I understand that, and you're making some interesting points. But on the other hand, if a lot of people opt out, then you may very well have a significant reduction in herd immunity. And one of the areas you mentioned before, you mentioned babies. That's one of the things that Ed Richards said he's particularly concerned about is infants who are below vaccination age and who don't have any immunity to these diseases yet. And other groups that are particularly at risk, like immune suppressed people, such as organ recipients. Those people are on drugs that suppress their immune systems, and so they're particularly vulnerable. And those are the people in particular, he says, that will be the first victims if there is an outbreak of one of these diseases because people refuse.
Well, first point on infants, Stuart. One is nature has provided a very important protection historically for infants. Mothers pass on antibodies when they're breastfeeding to their infants, and so infants, when they're breastfeeding, are shielded under maternal antibodies, and are often that's a natural protection that's provided. It's not until they're weaned that they actually become vulnerable, and we're doing all of our vaccination well inside that window. In fact, you can argue that we're vaccinating infants way too early at birth, at 2 months, 4 months, 6 months. The biggest assault on infant vaccination programs is very, very early. And that's historically new. We've never done the degree of intervention in infant immune development like we're doing now. So that's point number one. And then I come back to the other point, Stuart. There are some people at risk. Absolutely, anyone who suffers from an infectious disease, whether they get sick in very rare and tragic cases they die. Every casualty of an infection is dangerous. But on the other side, we can have casualties of the intervention. And one of the things we need to have very good data on whenever we're mandating interventions is the balance of risk and benefit to the herd. And if we don't have balanced, thoughtful, disinterested decision makers who are making those judgments about risk and benefit, then we're going to have a systematically biased set of policies with no check and balance. And I would argue that that's the situation we're in now. We have public health advocates who basically get blinded by the idea that herd immunity is a helpful concept, and everything they see about vaccination is good, and every risk they see is zero. If you actually read the literature, and there was a study done a couple of years ago that did a review of all the science, the published science that had a bearing on the relationship between autism and mercury or heavy metals. And these authors looked at about, they had a sample of, ultimately they narrowed it to 58 studies. And of those 58 studies, 43 found a link, provided evidence supporting a link between mercury and autism.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and we're continuing the debate on constitutional rights as pertains to vaccinations. Do you have a right to refuse vaccinations? Do you not? Is it a good idea? Should you follow expert advice? Should you not? We've heard from Mark Blaxall. We've heard from Ed Richards. And as I promised at the beginning of the program, we're going to give Ed Richards the last word. But first, our Madison Minute.
Before she married James, Dolly Madison was married to attorney John Todd of Philadelphia. Dolly married John in 1790 when she was 21 years old. From 1791 to 1793, they lived together in a modest three-story brick house on the northeast corner of 4th and Walnut Streets. John's law office was on the first floor. Dolly entertained in a parlor on the second floor. Tragically, John Todd died during a yellow fever epidemic in 1793, along with his and Dolly's younger son, three-month-old William Isaac Todd, leaving behind Dolly and their older son, John Payne Todd. Their house, now known as the Todd House, is owned by the National Park Service and is open for tours. The Todd House reflects the lifestyle of 18th-century Philadelphia's middle class and offers insights into a part of Dolly Payne Todd Madison's life that is often overlooked. With a Madison Minute, I'm Jim Blaylock.
And now it's time to finish up our discussion of the constitutionality of compulsory vaccination. And here with the last words is LSU professor Ed Richards. Ed feels so strongly about the things he's saying that he's a little bit irritated with me for even presenting Mark Blaxall on this program.
Be very careful about the false notion of two sides to a story. There's probably been no more destructive issue where that has prevailed than the autism controversy, where there was never any reputable science, and yet there's huge litigation, false hopes among parents, parents being frightened out of getting their children vaccinated, parents who vaccinated their children frightened that they'd harm their children. These issues often don't have two sides, and when you artificially accept there must be another side, you empower these cranks and allow them to manipulate the system.
Well, Ed Richards of LSU Law School, we very much appreciate you coming on the show.
It's been a lot of fun.
And that's our show, the rest of the story about compulsory vaccination. I'd like to thank very much Ed Richards, a law professor at Louisiana State University, as well as Mark Blaxall, the president of the Canary Party and the author of The Age of Autism. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our distribution engineers are Bob Hoffman and Larry Mayer. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, it's your Constitution, and you need to learn about it.
Economist.